These people know how to lead us wherever they want us to go because they study history and we don't. What was Rome? What was Rome? A republic? What kind of republic? They had a constitution. Did you know that? What happened to Rome? It fell into oligarchy, and then into dictatorship, then into rampant immorality, declined, fell, and became the Vatican. The Roman Empire never fell. It changed its name. The emperor became the Pope. The old pantheon of Roman gods became the pantheon of saints, and they are identical.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. We're online again this week, but hopefully we'll have a City Council guest next week as we go back to the studio. As many people suspected in the second hour, our station manager Pat Hart had different ideas to us about how to cover national and international affairs. And a BCFM politics show doppelganger has appeared on our old station, BCFM. It's called The Bristol Agenda and is on every Monday. So we'll be having a listen to their coverage of the Beirut explosion this week and unrest in Belarus. Is it an improvement or just a watered-down version of mainstream media propaganda? Also, Joe Biden accepts the US Democratic Party nomination at a virtual convention, which seems designed to stifle dissent and make it look like party members approve it all. Very easy to do in a virtual convention, but not so easy to do if everyone is meeting and there are maybe a few hecklers, you never know. But you can't do that if it's a virtual convention. Also, the World Economic Forum and Prince Charles are preparing the Great Reset for when the international banksters crash the global economy and try and blame it on COVID or a war or Brexit. This week, we hear from a man who would lead us into the brave new Great Reset world. From the annual Davos conference, one of the key organisers, Klaus Schwab. And two documentaries this week, Coup 53, the untold story of the 1953 CIA and MI6-led coup against Iran's Prime Minister Mossadegh, as well as another film, Plandemic 2, which looks at the 2020 June, July and August, will it ever end, censorship epidemic spreading across the world just as the pandemic has run out of steam. Finally, another of my YouTube films has been censored this week, a 1989 ABC Australia 60 Minutes documentary about Satanism and ritual abuse, murder and child sacrifice in the UK. Yes, 1989. And of course, we saw in the early 1990s the beginning of the shutdown of TV investigative journalism in the UK. Anyway, joining me to review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
Been to the pub again this week or not?
Nope.
No? Are you deliberately staying away?
Pretty much. I mean, when I used to go to the pub, it was like going to a nightclub and just sitting there with a pint. That just doesn't cut it, really.
Okay, so we did cover last week, didn't we, the injunction, which I've just got my court papers through today, which is an attempt in Bristol to keep travellers out of the part of the city called St. Werburgh's. I put an article up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk on last week's show. It's also on the Land Is Ours website. That's tlio.org.uk. You can find it there, really explaining some of the background to this. One of the most amazing things, Martin, which we didn't cover last week, is the fact that Thangam Debonair MP, she's right in the middle of this injunction and she's housing spokesperson for Labour.
Well, I don't know what her exact role is in relation to the injunction, but I was aware that she was now housing spokesperson. Yeah.
I mean, what do you make of this? Because, I mean, I'll put a link up to our show page at thisweek.org.uk to a fascinating article in the Traveller's Times, which is looking at the whole business of the new attempt to criminalise trespass, which is being spearheaded by Jacob Rees-Mogg and the Tory party. This will make traveling people living in caravans, things like that, a criminal offence, and the police will then have to go and arrest these people. And it seems as if here in Bristol, even though we've got a Labour mayor, they're trying to sort of almost do the groundwork for what is effectively a Jacob Rees-Mogg land grab.
Well, we shall see how this plays out. I'm not au fait with all the details of all of this, so it's not easy for me to comment other than in a general way. Clearly, criminalisation of travelling at the same time as we're having a massive economic recession and loads of people are going to lose their housing is clearly a criminalisation of poverty.
But that's not on, is it? And also, of course, this is a massive struggle that's been going on. Actually, it's been going on for centuries, really, hasn't it?
Well, indeed, yeah. I mean, we can either look at it in terms of what's happened recently with the universal credit and all the rest of it, or you can look at it in a more general way as the control by the landed interest in politics in general. And, of course, you know, they're just about to rip up the planning system that was brought in after the war so that the developers will basically get a free rein to do everything they want. And you can see that the people driving Tory policy at the minute are of the disaster capitalism ilk. I mean, Dominic Cummings is a classic disaster capitalist, as is Jacob Rees-Mogg. So they regard all of the things that are going on now as an opportunity to ram stuff through, which in normal times would be much more resisted than it will be.
I mean,
and
even
they're just hoping to achieve as much as they can of their extreme agenda.
But why is it, Martin, you haven't really addressed the point. Why is a Labour city doing the groundwork for what is effectively a Jacob Rees-Mogg privatisation of land and criminalisation of traveller policy?
Well, land is already privatised, so let's just leave that aside. I don't know what the thinking behind
that is. Well, no, hang on. We're talking about the privatisation of rights. Okay, yeah. So gypsies and travellers do have rights, but they're now saying, well, actually, it's going to be a crime.
Yeah, well, I understand all of that, but you wanted to talk about what the council's doing. If you ask me, well, I don't know what the council are doing. I'm not a councillor.
I mean, no, I'm asking you really what the Labour Party is. Why is the Labour Party doing something like this?
Well, I don't know, because you'd have to ask the people responsible. But I would suggest to you that there's two possibilities. Either it's being carried out by officials who've got their own let's keep everything tidy mentality, or there's a more political agenda behind it, which is more than likely that people in St. Werburgh's have complained about travellers that they don't want them.
Well, they've been doing that for decades. They've been doing that for decades, Martin.
Well, indeed. But one way or another, that's the most likely explanation. But if you ask me what's the explanation, the answer is I don't know.
Are you saying it's maybe officials? Well, it won't be just officials, because certainly both Steve Pearce, who's the cabinet member for Waste, who's dealing with this. I was quite shocked to find that it's not Paul Smith from Housing, but it's Steve Pearce for Waste, whose budget this is coming out of. And obviously the mayor himself will have both signed this off.
Well, OK, so you've done a bit of digging there and you've got some more information than I knew. So I've no idea what's driving it. This kind of thing doesn't work, because even if you were to be successful in pushing travellers out of St. Werburgh's, they'll have to go somewhere else. But don't forget, many travellers are not registered to vote, and large numbers of people don't participate in elections, and therefore they don't get much of a say.
So the article I'm pointing to, and I'll put a link up onto our show page, is on the Travellers Times. It says the government is set to pass new hostile anti-traveller laws this autumn. It was on the 22nd of July this was published. Lawyers and campaigners are ready to act after the government recently announced new hostile anti-traveller laws, which could include criminalisation of trespass, were delivered this autumn. The laws are set to follow the government's consultation on unauthorised camps and sites last year and the Tory party's annual 2019 election manifesto promised to criminalise trespass. Traveller law experts are already set to challenge any new laws in court, say lawyers. At the time the consultation was in progress, we made it clear, they say, why we felt the government's proposals were discriminatory and unlawful, senior lawyer from Community Law Partnership told Travellers Times. In the government bring these proposals in and we're already instructed to take forward court challenges. Last week, Home Secretary Priti Patel told MPs new laws based on the 2019 government consultation on unauthorised traveller sites would be brought forward in the autumn. Earlier this month, Jacob Rees-Mogg, leader of the House of Commons, told MPs the government intended to deliver on its election promise to make trespass a criminal offence. So there are some people, Martin, who, you know, this is this traveller injunction that Marvin Rees and Steve Pearce are trying to get. I mean, our people we elect not to do this sort of thing, though, I would suggest, is some are calling Marvin Rees Marvin Rees-Mogg.
Well, I mean, you've just made that quip. I've no idea what the thinking behind it is. There is a political tension between people who are homeowners in an area and people who are travellers who are basically consuming local services but not paying into them and all the rest of it. It could be that. It could be just a tidy-minded attitude. It could be anything. But it's, you know, it's your right to draw attention to it. And ultimately, of course, people have got to decide what side they're on in most of these issues.
Yeah, and I mean, the whole thing sort of seemed to kick off around about February with Conor Gogarty in the Bristol Post doing what I can only describe as an absolutely appalling article, which was taking photographs around traveller encampments along streets, most of which are unoccupied streets. So in other words, there's no houses on those streets where travellers in vehicles and caravans are. Taking pictures of graffiti, also pictures of laughing gas canisters, those silver canisters you sometimes see in the street, pictures of excrement, basically blaming the travellers as a whole for excrement in the street, at graffiti, vandalism, leaving rubbish lying around, and that sort of thing, which is a, you know, there is nothing to necessarily pin that to these people, because, you know, as well as I do, you know, if there's a traveller encampment and someone wants to dump something, they'll dump it there. It may not be these travellers doing this at all.
Well, that would then fit in with the sort of what they had in New York, where, you know, if you allow a window to be broken, you know, this is the zero tolerance approach, which is a US approach from years ago. And therefore, you know, if you've got travellers, it then encourages other people to come and dump stuff where the travellers are.
American thing, isn't it? This whole idea of criminal trespass. In fact, I know people in the States who have been arrested just for literally walking into a field.
Yeah. And of course, in the United States, many people sleep in their cars and are forced to do so. And they've got huge tent cities, people living in the underground. We're going to be more Americanized as a result of our political and economic path. And that's what America looks like, with guns.
Also this week in The Guardian, we've had George Monbiot's article, English landowners have stolen our rights. It's time to reclaim them. And he puts in a little bit there about the travellers too. Landed power, he says, is built on theft, slavery and colonial looting. It crushes our freedoms. A new campaign seeks to decolonise the countryside. So I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk as well. He's talking really about a new campaign here, Martin. So the battle lines are being drawn, aren't there? For the, I mean, I suppose the interesting thing about this is we're just about to pull out of the European Convention on Human Rights. Looks like Rees-Mogg is ready straight away to start smashing those rights, particularly for travellers here and gypsies, to pieces.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the criminalisation of squatting some years ago by the government was an extreme.
Well, it's not criminal. Just a minute. It's criminalisation of squatting in residential properties.
Yes, I know, but that means that option is no longer open to people. And it was a safety valve through previous recessions in the country that people could squat and therefore save themselves rent. And many people who were squatting used to be in work, and therefore they needed to save their money, themselves rent, because they couldn't afford to live otherwise. And it's just basically an attack on the poor. And the poor and criminalisation of people's necessary response to not having adequate resources.
The problem here, of course, is, I mean, you touched on it a minute ago, is you've got people being moved out of suburbs. Where are they going to go from there? We had a couple of years ago, didn't we, the Greenbank Road and Greenbank Cemetery, where the mayor lives, they were moved out of there. So the point here being that the sites that are provided are way, way, way out of town. Most of these people are living and working in Bristol. I mean, okay, so a lot of them are itinerants that will be on the festival circuit, but obviously they want to make an income and they've got jobs in the city centre. The last thing place on the world they want to be put is over in Avonmouth, next to a sewage works, right next to a toxic incinerator, right next to a motorway. It's a horrific sight. And also, I haven't been down there for a few months, but last time I was down there, it's basically full to bursting. So they are not providing the sites for people to go. And yet they are one of the biggest landowning as a proportion of the area, local authorities in the country.
Yes, and we've had some fairly articulate people talking about living in vehicles and lobbying to be allowed to do it and so on. But then you've got all sorts of other people who are just living in vehicles without much of a political agenda. And basically, ultimately, the political system serves those inside the system. So you have to have a registered address and a vote, and then the local councillor, whoever it is, may take notice of your opinion. But if you're not registered to vote, you're basically a target. But so anybody can complain and say, look, I pay my council tax. What are these people doing at the end of the road here? What are you going to do about it?
Anyway, we'll do our best to get some of those people
to happen as well
in the next few weeks to give their point of view. George, just to finish up, what George Monbiot says is, I think, fascinating, the way he teases this out to the wider, bigger picture. The freedom to walk, he says, is as fundamental a right as the freedom of speech. But in England, it's denied across 92% of our land, though we give landowners £3 billion a year from our own pockets in the form of subsidies. We're banned from most of what we pay for.
Well, that's right. And the other thing, of course,
this is welfare, isn't it?
Yes, the quantitative easing, which keeps the economy going, raises land values. So all those who own property have their basic value of their property protected by the taxpayer, which of course is not free market economics. We threw that out of the window years ago, and all the same people who own these properties then claim about people who are scrounging, for example, who are claiming benefits while living in trucks.
I mean, we're at the same time,
their house prices have been underpinned by the taxes those people are paying when they go to
it's
work.
It's not fair, is it? Extraordinary. So we're heading towards a situation, maybe by the beginning of next year, where it could be a crime for you to stop alongside or on the road. I mean, literally a crime. Say, for example, if your vehicle breaks down and you feel like, you know, you're going to have to stay overnight in it, you know, in a sleeping bag or whatever, you know, you're going to be arrested. Anyway, so more on that in future weeks, no doubt. We've also, Martin, this week had a St Paul's residents being concerned about a 5G mast installed. People living nearby claim they weren't properly consulted about the plans. Now, I've just been looking at this. We hear a lot of denial that 5G can be dangerous. But actually, there are studies around that say it is dangerous. What do you think? Do you think there's a whole hoo-ha about nothing 5G?
Well, in various parts of the country, I believe that local authorities have refused to allow 5G on the grounds that they don't know whether it's dangerous or not, and not enough research has been done. But I imagine in Bristol, you've got a fairly substantial lobby that are behind this idea of the smart city and the idea that everything is going to be, you know, upgraded electronically, and it's going to make Bristol a happening place.
Well, one of the most important parts of that lobby is this woman called Freya Lockwood, who I've several times tried to contact. She initially agreed to do an interview and then she backtracked. And she is in charge of something called Bristol Smart Cities, paid at least in part. I think she's part of a partnership, maybe paid by Business West or somebody or some government department to roll this out. But she's not prepared to really defend, certainly on this program, what she's doing. And she is somebody who's come hot foot from Kinetic, which is the privatized military research arm of the Ministry of Defence.
Yes, and there's quite a lot of evidence to link 5G with military matters, which is, of course, the justification for the government banning Huawei from operating in Britain, because it's got military implications and all the rest of it. I can't claim to understand every aspect of everything to do with it, but as usual, the powers that be and the vested interests proceed crab-like to their goals while most ordinary people are unaware of what's going on.
Okay, a biggie this week, though, Martin, is the, I mean, it was just at halfway through the bulletin this morning, sneaked in just about one line, that the national debt has now crept over £2 trillion. And not only that, it's also surpassing 100% of the country's GDP for the first time in over 50 years. Now, maybe we could start with the second part of this. What does that mean if the national debt surpasses the country's GDP? What's going on there?
Well, I mean, it's a significant milestone, but nevertheless, it doesn't make that much difference whether it surpasses the GDP by a bit or not by very much. The real question you have to ask yourself is, what's the overall situation?
Well, it does, doesn't it? Surely, Martin, it does. It makes a big difference if your debt is more than your money you're making every year.
Yes, but it could be, at some point, it may get to the point where it's worth 3 years of GDP. And many countries are in debt to the point where it's worth three years.
Well, that means that the debt is actually dominating the economy, not the actual economy itself.
Well, that's the thing that's happening all over the world. Because we've had the 2008 crash, that what should have happened, according to the free market textbook, is that Jacob Rees-Mogg should have been bankrupted. His Somerset Capital Asset Management should just have been allowed to go to the wall, and he should have been sent to collect his P45, but he wasn't, and nor was anybody else. And of course, that's what's happened. We've been bailing these people out, and when we hit this latest speed bump, they've been bailed out again. And in fact, there's no solution to this. They're going to have to keep printing money until it crashes. And then there will be a massive social struggle over the physical infrastructure society.
Can't we do some sort of jubilee where we just shrug the debt off, forgive it completely?
Well, that's what should have happened. If we'd had the right political forces in power in 2008, that's exactly what we would have done.
Well, hang on, because, we bailed them out and we tried to take control of them, but we didn't actually the bank.
No, we didn't even try to take control of them. Well, what happened was they were bailed. They should have been nationalised. Now, if you've nationalised the entire banking system, so Somerset Capital Asset Management, for example, might have some assets which you could then take into the public sector and take them off Jacob Rees-Mogg because he's bankrupt. You could have done all of that if you'd had a political leadership in the West that understood the problems and had been preparing to deal the blow to the private financial sector, which was inevitable if you know anything about economics. But basically, they're ignoramuses. They bought into the lie that the financial markets had solved all the problems of capitalism and all we had to do is let them get on with it. So they were totally unprepared when the whole thing went tits up.
Martin, surely this debt is a bit of a time bomb, isn't it? At some point, it's just all going to go bang.
Yes, it is. And as Keynes pointed out in the 1930s, debts that can't be paid won't be paid. And that's not a political point, that's a logical point. And basically what we've done now, they've blown a massive bubble because the stock market, even as the US economy collapses through the floor with 1 million people a week claiming unemployment benefits, new people a week claiming unemployment benefits, the stock market is heading for the stratosphere because of all the money that's been printed. The only end to that is a big bang. And I don't just mean a big bang in the financial markets.
So are we talking here about what's going to be the real cause of that, do you think? Is it, you know, because it does look as if the banksters are ready for it.
Well, they've got the deep state behind them and it's therefore not a free market setup. But what could happen is you could get a run on some currency somewhere or the collapse of some major player in the market. And that will cause the crash. There's so many different ways.
I mean, well, the main way, Martin, is always been through overnight money. And this is the money which
the repo
financial
market.
Institutions use to pay off their debts as it approaches midnight. So if they've borrowed money overnight, they may need to borrow a little bit more over just literally, over the space of 24 hours in order to settle those debts that haven't been paid when it approaches midnight. And that money is usually very cheap because the banking system is reliable. But it can do is what happened back in September last year, as we've discussed a few times, is that money started to become more and more expensive. Even to borrow for a day, it's becoming expensive to do. And so that is exactly what happened in 1929 in the in the great stock market crash.
It's the same thing happened in 2008.
That's right. So isn't it? This is the thing I think we need to be watching every night on the news. They should be telling us how expensive this money is to borrow, because
that's a great indication
of how healthy the system is and whether the banks themselves have confidence that other banks will be able to pay them back the next day.
Well, that's one of the things that's particularly pernicious about this, is we don't know who's being bailed out. And the argument is, if we tell you who's being bailed out, then you'll know who hasn't got any money and there will be a run on that bank. So in other words, you've got to give us loads of taxpayer money to bail the system out, but we can't possibly tell you who's got it. And it's all been actually in the US farmed out to BlackRock, which is a private equity organization. And they're deciding who gets what. And guess what? They've got an awful lot of it. Because they're the biggest players in the market. Now, this is insane, really. It doesn't fit any kind of textbook action at all. But of course, we were told basically that there was a one-off systemic failure in 2008. Won't happen again. Give us all the money and we'll just sort it all out.
Well, I mean, you're very good at complaining about
predictably.
You're very good at complaining about the way things are. But what would you do?
Well, as I said to you before, if you had the right political leadership in 2008, you'd have nationalised.
No, now, not back in 2008.
Well, you can do the same thing now. But what we've got in the United States is Trump, and what we've got over here is Boris, and neither of them believe in nationalising anything, let alone the banking system.
But what would you do, Martin? I don't want to hear about things that are not going to happen. I want to hear, what would you do?
Well, what is going to happen, if I was the Prime Minister, I would nationalise the banks, Tony.
Right.
But I'm not the Prime Minister, and they're not going to.
Well, they might have to at some point, mightn't they?
Well, they will. No, they won't. What they're doing is they're chucking money at it, but without taking control of it. Which is the worst of both worlds.
Interesting. Well, look, we've had another big event this week, and that is the sentencing of Hashim Abedi for the Manchester Arena bomb. Let's have a listen now to Daniel Sanford on the BBC yesterday talking about the sentence for that bomb attack.
Well, it was the longest possible sentence the judge could hand down. Daniel Sanford has been following the Hashim Abedi case at the Old Bailey throughout. And Daniel, he got 55 years for his part in the murder of 22 people at the Ariana Grande Manchester Arena concert in 2017. What exactly was said in court today?
Well, after more than a day's harrowing testimony from survivors and the bereaved relatives affected by the Manchester Arena murders, the judge came to the moment when he was to sentence Hashim Abedi. Hashim Abedi had been brought to court but had refused to come up to court from the cells, so the judge was addressing an empty dock. He said that he believed that Hashim Abedi was as guilty as his brother, Salman Abedi, who had actually detonated the bomb. He described the murders as atrocious crimes, and he said that he was satisfied that Hashim Abedi had known that the target was to be an Ariana Grande concert, where he knew that a large number of children and teenagers were present, and the judge noted that in fact almost half of those killed in the explosion were either children or teenagers. He said that he would have given Hashim Abedi a whole life order. He would have never been released, except he couldn't because he was under 20 at the time of the bombing. But in passing a minimum term of 55 years on the life sentence, meaning that the parole board won't even consider release for 55 years, he warned that Hashim Abedi should be under no illusions that he may never be released.
And relatives of those killed have been in court throughout this process. How did they react to the sentence today?
Well, clearly, they would have preferred a whole life order, but they had been told in advance that that wasn't going to be possible. I think generally they were all pleased with the huge length, the record length of the minimum term.
Daniel Sanford there.
Yeah, so, Martin, what's your thoughts about Hashim Abedi, and did he do it?
Well, the interesting thing, we've got to peel back several layers of observation here. First of all, both of them were members of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group basically began in the 1980s inside Libya, mostly in Tripoli, and they've had an intimate relationship with the Western intelligence services, specifically with MI6. And in actual fact, many Libyans live in Manchester because that's where they were based. So the Abedi the Abadi brothers were going backwards and forwards, or one of them at least was going backwards and forwards to Libya to fight in Libya against Gaddafi with the connivance of MI6. And of course, they've been conniving with this group back to the 1980s. David Shaler and Anning Machon pointed this out in from MI5, pointed this out in the 1990s, that the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group were being given resources by MI6 in order to carry out attacks inside Libya. Now, you could argue that what's happened here is blowback. If you play footsie with those kind of people for 30 or 40 years and you allow them to operate in one of your major cities, then this is the sort of thing that might happen. But you could get deeper than that, because the father was still working with MI6 when he was over there fighting Gaddafi. He's still in Libya. He's been on the record as saying that he thinks this is a setup by MI6 to make his sons look bad. I don't know whether that's true. It could be. It might not be.
The way MI6 deals with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group.
Are a Western front organisation.
Martin, it's interesting the way MI6...
That shows that they may well be behind what's happened, like Martin, 9-11.
It shows, doesn't it, how MI6 treat people who deal with them a little bit like Skripal, potentially. Anyway, I mean, certainly one of the, I think, most likely things that's happened with Skripal is him wanting to return back to Russia. And then all of a sudden he's caught up in this so-called Skripal affair, the so-called poisoning, where this deadly nerve agent doesn't kill him or his daughter. And then he disappears off the face of the earth. So a similar sort of thing with Ramadan Abadi, who was the alleged bomber and Hashim Abadi's father. The Daily Mail, back in March, though, the height of the pandemic, I didn't notice this one, Martin. It says his father was arrested and then disappeared after the attack. He's now been tracked down and living in Istanbul. He was captured by the police in 2017, hours after his son's attack. He's now receiving medical treatment in Turkey's Istanbul, according to sources. The father of the Manchester Arena terrorists, alleged terrorists anyway, was arrested in Libya following the bombing, which killed 22 people, is receiving medical aid in Istanbul. While it's yet unknown what the father is being treated for, sources told the Mail it's being paid for by the Libyan government, who he previously worked for as a civil servant. This has come out through the Daily Telegraph.
Yeah, and I think what will be very interesting is to follow all of these linkages back. I would ask the question, what relationship did these brothers and the father have with British intelligence? I bet you it goes back years. And of course, the father being in Istanbul, I didn't know that, but it doesn't surprise me, because the other main input into the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group comes from the Turkish intelligence services, MIT.
You know what I can sense?
Because they're pro-Muslim Brotherhood, etc.
I know what I can sense is a little politics show investigation with you and I flying out to Istanbul to interview this guy if we possibly can. It'd be very interesting to hear what he had to say about all this.
What he said, as I remember, Tony, was that the whole thing was a setup by MI6 and that his son was innocent. That may not be true, but that's what he said.
Okay, so, I mean, there are various aspects to this attack which are very, very strange. The Ariana Grande concert, not least of which is that the evidence, so-called evidence, which said that Salman Abadi was even there, was taken in a lift somewhere, but everything else had been blacked out. So you couldn't tell. It looked like a lift. You couldn't tell if it was actually taken in the Manchester Arena at all. It was just a silhouette of him with a kind of silver edge around him, where the whole of the rest of the background had been blacked out by whoever presented that, I imagine, the anti-terrorist police, to the press.
Well, at the very least, there's probably a lot of embarrassment inside MI5 that these people were their protégés, and we've heard very little about that. I think that's the main point that people need to take home. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group is a glove puppet for MI6 and has been for decades.
Daniel Sanford did not share with the listeners to the BBC yesterday some of the disconcerting feelings or disconcerted families of those that died, who have been finding it almost impossible to get any information out of the security services whatsoever about why Salman Abadi was reported to the anti-terrorist hotline, etc. that various things happened, and it was just no action was taken whatsoever. And not only that, even though he was supposed to have been one of the top people on their watch list, he still managed to assemble so-called a bomb and carry out this attack. But I think one of the most interesting aspects of all of this case, and I keep coming back to this Sky TV interview with a woman called Dawn Waddy, who saw a suspicious woman at the Manchester Arena who may have actually been the real bomber. And I did contact Dawn, spoke to her briefly on social media, and then she intimated, she didn't actually spell it out, but she hinted to me that there was pressure of some sort being put on her not to be interviewed and not to talk to me after she'd given this interview we're going to hear now to Sky News.
We sat down in our seats to start from the beginning. We had somebody sat next to us and looked very suspicious. She was fidgeting all the time with a bag on the floor across her. She was by herself.
What was she doing?
She was looking in the direction of where the explosion actually happened all night and smirking to herself. Now, I got suspicious myself, and my friend said to me, who was actually sat next to her, directly next to her, had said, "I don't like this." She was fidgeting with her bag and the zips and on and off, hands in the pockets, and it puts you on edge.
What did you do about it?
I told security, who then informed a higher security. They were up and down the stairs where she was sat discreetly watching her. I knew what they were doing. Nothing was actually done about it. And then later on, as the concert was going and Ariana actually came on the stage, she was getting more and more agitated. The bag was then on the floor, and I actually sat next to her, and I said, and I actually nudged her arm intentionally so I could actually speak to her. And I said, "Oh, sorry about that. Oh, are you by yourself?" And she said, "Yes," and she spoke to me, but I didn't understand her.
So we don't know whether this lady had anything to do with it. But you were worried enough to talk to security.
Yes.
They listened to you, although you say that they didn't really do anything.
I don't think security did listen to me.
Then what happened?
Because then my daughter got very upset about things, Holly, and she went to security, and they basically told her, "How would you like it if someone accused you of this? We'll look into it," and nothing was done about it.
And then of course
the concert went on. This lady was more agitated. 1 to 2 minutes before the concert finished, this lady disappeared, and then of course the explosion went off in the other end of the of the stadium.
And what can you remember of that? What did you see?
It was just a huge boom. I never saw no smoke, no flashes or anything. And they were trying to blame the balloons, but there were some large helium balloons, but the boom was too big. It was too big. It couldn't have been a speaker because the music had finished. Ariana, she'd gone off the stage. So then everyone started screaming and just charged to the nearest exit, up the stairs. It was a stampede. It was just absolutely horrendous. People were pushing. People were pushing me. We was just running and running. And fortunately, our hotel is just 5 minutes away, so we ran and got into the hotel. But it was just absolutely horrendous, and the security was awful. I'm sorry to say that the security did nothing about it, and there should have been more security. And we walked through the doors when we had our tickets, and they scanned your tickets, and we wasn't even checked. They never checked bags at all. I never saw them check anybody's bags.
Well, that's Dawn Waddy speaking back in 2017 to Sky News, Martin. Looks like sort of scared off from being interviewed by me. I mean, I just wanted to follow that up and see how she got treated, but she was afraid to then speak afterwards for whatever reason. I suppose, the real big take home from this is what other motive might there have been rather than some Libyan terrorist doing this? What other things might be going on? Because we do know, don't we, from things like the Birmingham 6, the Guildford 4, that it's quite feasible for the British police, particularly when it's kind of regional or national squads, to fit people up.
Well, it's speculation, but the links between the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and MI6 go back decades. And of course, what they were doing inside Libya was pretty much this kind of thing.
Well, yeah, we've been through this, but what
might be
another?
I'm going to move on from that, Tony.
Okay.
because in actual fact, we know that Western intelligence services, including MI6, have been major supporters of Islamist terrorism since the 1980s. We've been supplying weaponry and training to the same kind of people inside Syria. Now, it's and of course, the main story about 9/11 is that Al-Qaeda was set up by the Western intelligence services to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. But, oh, dearie me, they went rogue and they attacked us.
So
instead.
Why might Western intelligence services want to carry out an attack like this? Surely that's impossible.
No, it's not impossible. 9/11 was carried out by the Western intelligence services, wasn't it? And that was 3,500 people dead, not 27. Yeah. So, of course, there's an ongoing use of terrorism, strategy of tension, so that now MI5, MI6 can say, oh, dear, look what happened in Manchester. We need more resources to deal with this kind of thing. And, of course, what that means is they carry on producing these kind of events and then saying we need more power to deal with it. And people say, oh, it can't be the case that Western intelligence services would do that. And of course, for those people, you just point out that they have been working with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group for years. They knew exactly who they were.
Well, I mean, it does occur to me that a lot of this sort of really malicious type of, it was basically like a kind of psychological self-harming going on for political advantage began around, well, I mean, it's happened many, many times, but the latest big wave of this began around 1995. When Benjamin Netanyahu wanted to win, it looked as if he was going to lose the Israeli elections and the assassination over there that led to him. And then there were attacks by what certainly looked like Zionist terrorists on buses, and which were blamed on Palestinians. And so that may be where all this sort of thing started.
Well, the Israelis may well have a hand in this because they had a very strong relationship with these groups as well. And including Saudi Arabia as the main funder of all of this, they're our allies.
All around the time.
Them with weaponry all the time. The British military over there at the moment, helping them turn Yemen into hell on earth.
And that all happened around the time of the assassination of the great peacemaker, Yitzhak Rabin. Anyway, look, let's go on to look at COVID. And I'm looking forward to another little tussle with you, Martin, over this, mm-hmm. because we're going to hear from a local doctor now. There's a former BBC journalist, Anna Breeze, who's been putting up all sorts of interesting interviews on social media and on her website. And this time it's a local doctor, a company director who's called Greg. He's 51 years old, from Gloucestershire.
I'm not a journalist, but I have spent a few hours on the internet looking at UK government websites for my own sanity, and hopefully my findings will reassure others we are not in a state of chaos or waiting for Armageddon to smash into our lives. We just need to focus on those who are in danger and protect them whilst we all get back to business, back to how it was, and start chipping away at this £190 billion bill we've racked up tackling the COVID-19 situation. Many SMEs and big businesses have failed, struggled, or just hanging in there. One third, 34% of UK white-collar employees have gone back to work, lagging far behind our European counterparts, where almost three quarters of staff, 68%, have done so, according to analysis from US bank Morgan Stanley's research unit, AlphaWise. UK government borrowing is at £1.98 trillion. This is the highest since 1961. Okay, it does help with the world's fifth biggest economy, but it does not make good business or economic sense to have such a large, huge national debt.
So that's Greg from Gloucestershire. Martin, he's saying what many, many other people are saying is, look, let's protect people who are vulnerable and everyone else get back to normal. Otherwise, we're just fueling this debt crisis, which will end in tears.
Well, at least he's talking about the debt crisis rather than pretending he's a medical professional. Let's talk about the debt crisis. The reason we've got a debt crisis is because, as you pointed out earlier, in September, the repo market collapsed in the United States of America, just like in 2008. So the debt crisis is a result of that. The COVID is a cover that gives an excuse for governments to print money and give it to the banks. Now, the fact of the matter is this is now way out of control. They're going to have to print any amount of money now to keep the asset price inflation in the stock markets going. The moment they stop doing
we won't
go back to normal. The banking system will collapse. So you've got a situation where they must print more money.
Yeah, it's
otherwise
a kind of
it collapses. It's kind of
an addiction, and we'll be talking about that in the second hour. We've got Michael Hudson, a clip with him. But let's have a listen now to Andrew Wakefield. He's he's no longer a doctor, so-called discredited, who he says, anyway, he discovered MMR vaccine was giving young people autism. And for his pains, he was, well, not quite booted out of the country, but certainly booted out of the profession, as many doctors seem to be being now, by the General Medical Council when they come up with reports that the big pharma don't like. But anyway, this is his film. He was speaking here on the Richie Allen show last week about vaccines and his new film, 1986, The Act. But before we hear from that, Martin, this is the key thing that Andrew Wakefield's made this film about. 1986, The Act is his film. And this is the act in the United States which made governments responsible for any injuries that vaccines made by private companies cause.
Well, that's basically socialization of losses and privatization of profits, isn't it?
Okay, so let's have a listen to Andrew Wakefield now.
What are we talking about when we talk about RNA or DNA vaccines, and why are they different to vaccines that have gone before? And then, of course, further to that, why is that so important? So what are these RNA vaccines?
Okay, so historically, live viral vaccines like measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox, the oral polio, have been made by growing the virus in cell culture. The only way you can propagate them or grow the virus, make more of it, is to grow it in cell culture, because cells, viruses have to live in cells. And what they do is hijack the cell's machinery to make more of themselves. Now, in doing that, there were huge, huge problems that no one really ever got to learn about. Some of them are covered in the film, where when they used monkey kidney cells or dog kidney cells or kidneys from aborted fetuses, but mainly animal cells, what they were doing when they created that live viral vaccine is they were allowing viruses that were already in those cells that weren't harmful to monkeys or chickens or dogs,
right,
but could be very harmful to humans, into the vaccine. So you weren't just getting a measles vaccine, you were getting a slew of bad stuff as well. And they had no idea what the consequences might be. So with the oral polio vaccine and with the intramuscular polio vaccine, you were getting a monkey virus that caused cancer. And that was given to millions of people. Now, that's a real problem. So they had to get away from that. They haven't said this explicitly, but this is the subtext. They realized that in making new viral vaccines, they had to get away from this disastrous thing and just hope that it would brush over and the people who were going to die would die and it would all disappear into nothingness. So what they did is they said, okay, let's turn the person themselves into the factory for the virus. Let's give them the genetic material of the virus in a modified form so that that then produces the gene produces the protein, and it's the protein to which you mount the immune response. This is all terribly complicated, but basically it's using the human being as the source of producing the viral protein. Now that is potentially devastating. Let's say you give this RNA virus vaccine to a whole bunch of people, and it gets into their cells, and it turns on protein production of the virus. It turns on the viral protein production. And you start mounting an immune response to it. But let's just say 5, 10, 15% of the population develop an autoimmune response because that viral protein looks like something in their own bodies.
Right.
You can't switch that off. There's no way of switching that off. So if you cause an adverse reaction that doesn't start for 6 months, a year, 5 years after the vaccine's been given, but it creates a devastating autoimmune disease, there's nothing you can do about it. Oh, yes, there is. Sorry, there's one thing you can do about it. The pharmaceutical companies that make the drugs that treat the autoimmune disease can make a lot more money.
There you go. You're going back to the same gang that effectively gave you the vaccine that caused this problem inside you. You've brilliantly described it in a way that I think I understand it. That's amazing. In 15%, and that might be conservative, of people, their own body might have an autoimmune response to this invasive RNA vaccine and cause them catastrophic health problems. Do you imagine that anybody working in the laboratories of these big pharmaceutical companies, are they talking about this? Are they worried about it? Or are they not worried about it because of what you get into in the film? And folks, you've got to go to 1986theact.com, the brand new film. Dr. Andy Wakefield on the programme talking about it. Do you think anybody at these companies is saying, hang on, this might be catastrophic?
Yes, they are. There's no doubt that they're talking about it. They're fully aware of vaccine-induced autoimmune disease. The problem is not, you know, by all means, produce a vaccine. By all means, if people want a vaccine, produce it and they can have it. Yeah. They must volunteer for it, and they must do so with fully informed consent. But the trouble is, if you limit the safety studies to a few weeks or a month, and that problem doesn't start until 3 months, you're never going to pick it up. That's one of the problems. So the safety studies need to be designed properly. But they are fully aware of it, Richie, and that is why they demand protection from liability.
And it's that protection from liability which Andrew Wakefield's film 1986, The Act, is all about. Martin, this really is one of the biggest scams we've ever seen, isn't it? The idea that you make the government responsible for deaths and injuries due to your product, and then you start ramping it up to a $1 trillion industry.
Yeah, well, it's the case for these things to be run in the public sector under accountable conditions is, to my mind, overwhelming. And as you look at the healthcare system in a country like Cuba, it's not based on making money for anybody. And the same, if we're going to have a national health service here, the biggest expense of the national health service is buying drugs and vaccines from the pharmaceutical companies. The logical thing to do is make those pharmaceutical companies, just like the banks, into the public sector. And ultimately, you could have an economy which was maybe 80% public sector with a residual private sector for stuff that doesn't matter that much, consumer fripperies. But of course, we're not going in that direction because we live in a capitalist system which is driven by private profit.
Well, yes, but it's also driven by, well, we'll be hearing more about that in the second hour. I won't go there right now. Look, I tracked down a dentist this week who lives and works here in the Southwest. He is going to be breaking his cover, going public in a few days' time, maybe a week or 10 days' time. But he has had to resign from his dental practice because he totally disagrees with the way that his dental practice is dealing with the COVID-19. And the main problem, as we're here now, has been that they have instructed him that he's not allowed to discuss the pandemic with any of his patients. Now, what he's saying, and I think he's quite right to say this, is that that destroys the relationship of trust with his patients, and therefore he's been unable to carry on as a dentist. So let's have a listen to Dr. Anonymous, the Southwest dentist now.
I work in the southwest of England. I'm a dentist, been a dentist for a few decades. We've been dealing with viruses since I can remember. As a profession, we've dealt with AIDS, hepatitis, and all manner of viruses. There's quite a few parallels between this scare, and I do believe it is scaremongering, and the HIV outbreak. As an example, I was working in a maxillofacial unit in a hospital in Wales. We used to fix broken jaws and take out wisdom teeth, that kind of thing. And so I was taking out someone's wisdom tooth from HIV, and I reached up and moved the operating light so I could see more clearly. And my consultant said, "Oh, well done, you've given everybody AIDS now." And so the kind of panic, which obviously is complete nonsense, the kind of panic they were spreading back then, they're spreading again now. I remember we would not treat HIV-positive patients. We had to send them to the hospital initially, and we started seeing HIV-positive patients at the end of the day and then having to squat down the whole surgery afterwards. And they're going to do, I believe, and do very similar things with COVID-19. They're going to tell people that they're positive, and then they will be treated like a biohazard, and will be treated in the same way, I believe. The PCR test that they used back in the day for HIV, it's the same test they're using now for COVID-19. It's not diagnostic. It can pick up some things, but not all things. I have a very good friend who worked with a lot of HIV patients as a nurse, and he told me that back in the day, when HIV was first out, they would choose whether they were going to resuscitate a patient, not on the status of their HIV, but on the status of whether they were straight or gay. So there's a straight man in with pneumonia and HIV positive, and there's a straight and had a gay man in with pneumonia and HIV positive. The gay man would be put down as not for resuscitation. And I think this kind of thing that we are probably going to be facing very soon here, as you can see from what is going on in New Zealand and Australia, with police state basically dominating the headlines, if you will have a look on the internet.
Was there a moment for you when you decided, well, actually, this is gone beyond what I think is reasonable, the measures the government are taking?
Yeah, I think it was Lord Sumption I heard on the radio or saw in a newspaper. I can't remember exactly which, but you know, the Supreme Court Judge Lord Sumption, retired now, who said this is what a police state looks like. And at that point, I thought, oh my God, he's so right. We're locked away in our houses, hiding behind our sofas, clinging onto our hands, you know, for dear life, and wondering what's coming next. And every single one of our rights has been eroded one by one. There's no right to get together to pray, for example, at churches, or to even talk with family, or to discuss the legalities of this entire lockdown, or indeed no opportunity for scientists and doctors and dentists to get together.
How has it actually affected you, you know, in your profession? Things like basic things like income, day-to-day work.
Yeah, I mean, we had to close, obviously, like all dentists in this country. I want to point out that around the world, dentists were deemed to be important to health, and they carry on working. But in the UK, we were told that your mouth is not important. Well, that's clearly a lie. I mean, there's undeniable links between gum disease and diabetes, gum disease and breast cancer, gum disease and Alzheimer's, gum disease and heart disease, etc. The list goes on and on. So the health of your mouth is vital to the rest of your body. And to leave people with abscesses and infections and with terrible toothache and broken teeth and broken dentures and bridges falling out, it's just a crime. You know, they did not need to do that. It was completely out of all proportion. We have been dealing with viruses, like I say, for as long as I can remember. So there's nothing new about this virus. So I've worked for every flu pandemic before, and obviously, I guess you'll be fully aware, and your listeners will be fully aware, that in 2017, 2018, more people died from the flu. So we had 50,000 deaths then, and in 1969 we had 80,000 deaths. So this has been blown out of all proportion.
And Martin, our anonymous doctor, he is a doctor, but he's a dentist, yep. Having to leave his profession, or he's been forced to leave there, and he should be blowing his cover in a few days. But I mean, he's saying this is a massive overreaction. He's quoting various figures, and of course the main point here is that professionals who we go to as experts on these sorts of subjects are being told, well, you've got to conform to national government policy or else you're out.
Well, that's right. I mean, and who decides that? Well, that's a question, isn't it? You know, I'm not an expert on any of these things. I'm not disputing he may be absolutely right about it all. He may not. The question is, what's the political power structure How are these decisions made? What's the basis of those
decisions? Well, I mean, whatever it is, it doesn't matter in a way. If it's eroding the trust between a doctor and his patient, this is a major, major infringement of our civil liberties.
Yeah, but you brought out that many people have lost their jobs in the US, a million a week. And as they lose their jobs, they lose health care insurance. So in actual fact, they don't have a relationship with any doctors or dentists at all because they don't have any insurance.
Well, that's not the point.
Therefore,
the question of whether how they're treated
doesn't even arise.
It's not the point we're making, really, that. Anyhow, let's move on because we've got, I think it's our final clip on COVID this week, which is an Omaha, Nebraska, in the Nebraska COVID hearings. This is Dr. Tabor.
My name is Dr. Tabor. I am in private practice in Omaha, Nebraska. I don't wear a mask. I see over 200 patients a week. I come in close proximity with every patient that I come across. Why haven't I contracted this so-called disease? Americans make up 5% of the world population, but yet we take in 65 to 70% of the world's pharmaceutical drugs. We are one of two countries that allows pharmaceutical advertisements on the television. But yet, 80% of Americans are suffering with a chronic disease associated with poor lifestyle choices. 700,000 people will die of heart disease this year alone. 600,000 people will die of cancer. 300,000 people will die of obesity this year. When is enough enough? If this is truly about health, then mandate healthy living, exercise, good food choices, chiropractic, outlaw tobacco and cigarettes, processed sugars. I believe it was Thomas Jefferson who stated, if people let the government decide what foods they eat and what medicines they take, their bodies will soon be in a sorry state as those souls who live under tyranny. You see, God made your body self-healing, self-regulating. If you give the body what it needs, it can be healthy. It is like the wilted plant that sits under the sun. An allopathic model to that is to shield the sun, to protect that plant against the sun, cut off its leaves, medicate or vaccinate that plant. But an epigenetic approach, a wellness approach, is to give that plant water, and it can be well. You see, your body is no different. We must eat well, move well, think well, and we can be well. In other words, your level of health is the genetic expression of your lifestyle choices. And I know full well that your body's ability to heal itself, to overcome disease and circumstances like corona, is far greater than anyone has ever permitted you to believe. Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, stated, unless we put medical freedom into the Constitution, a time will come when medicine will organize into an undercover dictatorship to restrict the art of healing to one class of men and deny equal privileges to others. That time is now. These masks have absolutely nothing to do with health, but everything to do with the complying with a false flag, tyrannical agenda. If we sacrifice our precious freedoms for temporary security, we will lose both. If you can't comprehend that statement, if you are blind to this agenda, then I am sorry. You have the eyesight of an eagle, but the vision of a clam.
Well, that's Dr. Tabor speaking at the state hearings on COVID-19 in Nebraska. Pretty fiery stuff, Martin, but I suppose his main point is about the pharmaceutical industry. If this was really about health, they would be mandating, he says, a healthy lifestyle.
Well, I mean, the argument in favour of a healthy lifestyle, as opposed to banging people full of drugs, is a no-brainer. But I'll come back to one that point I made earlier. 40% of the population in the US had no healthcare cover at all. It's now going to be over 50-60% with all these people being made unemployed. So the human rights of those people to see any doctor doesn't exist at all. And of course, that's the case in many parts of the world. So the idea that the healthcare system is oppressing us, in some countries, they haven't got a healthcare system to oppress you with. You just die in the street. And that's the norm in the United States of America.
Okay, so finally this week, in the first hour, I thought we'd have a look over in Essex, where I was on Monday, at Bradwell Nuclear Power Station. Well, Bradwell A is a very old Magnox station, rather like Hinkley A, and this is why I'm sort of taking an interest in this, because it's interesting to see what's happening on the Essex coast, to compare it with what's happening on the North Somerset coast. And what they're planning there is a gigantic new reactor. It's a brand new type of pressurized water reactor, which I don't know how much you know about reactors, Martin, but the only time I think a pressurized water reactor was used in the UK was Doon Rae, and it was a total disaster.
Well, as you know, I'm not a great fan of nuclear power for economic reasons. It basically doesn't pay its way, and it never has. But, yeah, what else can I say?
Okay, so, but anyway, okay, so the PWR, pressurised water reactor, I'm not sure if it ever delivered any electricity to the grid up at Dounreay. I know it took an immense amount of money to decommission. The interesting thing I think about Bradwell, even though it was decommissioned in 2002, it's still sitting there. The local people at Bradwell-on-Sea were promised by the nuclear authorities that the waste would all be taken away and that there would be a cap put on the concrete, the base of the station, and grass on top so people could have a picnic. Oh dear, that hasn't happened. We're talking about 18 years later now, and all they've got is the old reactor containment areas, the gigantic great concrete things, and the pressure vessels, the steel pressure vessels underneath them. The whole thing has just been left as mothballs, in mothballs, and a great big sort of steel cladding put over it. So you've got these kind of two gigantic great boxes by the side of the sea or the river, the estuary there at Bradwell-on-Sea. But anyway, when I was over there, I had a chat to the chair of Bradwell-on-Sea Parish Council, Jean Allen, about what she makes of this whole proposal, which she's about to tell us now, is going to be 10 times bigger at Bradwell B, this new proposal, than the old Bradwell A, the Magnox stations that shut back in 2002.
I'm Jean Allen. I'm chair of the Bradwell-on-Sea Parish Council. Now, this is Bradwell B. It's covering round about 450-500 acres. It is huge. The scale and the size of it is immense. There'll be two reactors. There will be accommodation. They are considering 500 permanent new homes, which, of course, our village has only got 380 households at the moment, so that's more than doubling the houses. There will be temporary sites. There will be recreational grounds. There will be anything that is going to be for up to 9,000 workers.
And how long are they saying it's going to take to build?
We're sort of estimating 10 to 12 years, I believe. The Parish Council did a survey. We sent a survey around to each household asking them opinions. We sort of put questions out, for the ordinary yes, no answers. At least 95% of those that answered were very much against it.
You're here in Essex, in an obvious sort of spot for something like this to happen.
I believe that if it had been on the size of the original Bradwell A, I don't think there would have been anywhere near the animosity that there is. But the scale of this development actually will totally envelop the whole of the village. Huge, huge park and ride areas, more roads, huge amount of, I think it's one HGV lorry every 70 seconds or something ridiculous. It's going to make such a difference to the whole area.
But look, it sounds to me like a bit of a David and Goliath struggle. Do you think you can beat it off?
I hope so. The whole point is that the government have got to realise, I think, that the cost is just ridiculous. There is so much more from renewable energy. There's so much more we could do without this dreadful industrialisation.
Do you think that there'll be a lot of local people will get jobs?
No, most definitely not. It'll all be labour that is bought in. There might be the odd one or two, but the what they call local jobs are 90 minutes away. That's the criteria. You can be local if you're you live 90 minutes away. That takes you to Cambridgeshire, past Ipswich. You know, that's not local. That's not a village job.
But what would you say to people who would accuse you, say, of NIMBYism and Ludditism? Because this is a piece of technology that's... It's got to go somewhere.
Has it? Has it got to go somewhere? On a personal note, I don't believe that. I think there are far, far better things, far, far better ways of producing energy that we do not need. We've got a wind farm in the village itself. Since it was built, it's sort of settled in. People don't really notice it now. Really and truly, if we sort of stuck with solar power, wind power, it would be better for us. We wouldn't have this is going to cause such an industrial wasteland, if you like, that I don't know. It will destroy our village.
Yeah, so that is Chairman of the Parish Council at Bradwell-on-Sea, which I visited earlier this week, Martin Jean Allen. Just to say, it was actually a fast breeder reactor, Dounreay, not a pressurised water reactor, and quite a lot of the pressurised water PWRs are around today. The latest on this is that, or one of the most important aspects of this whole business, is guess what? The 12-week consultation period for local people started just before the pandemic started. So they've got a consultation where people are supposed to come and visit them. Of course, many elderly retired people who simply can't leave their homes and they've been instructed to stay indoors. So there hasn't really been any proper consultation at all.
Well, and the government are about to rip up the existing planning regulations to build and build back better, as the Prime Minister says. And, you know, they were pretty weak anyway. As we know, developers and those who want to build stuff have basically got carte blanche in any case. But whatever limited mechanisms by which they could be controlled are about to be ripped up. And so the whole framework for town and country planning put in place by the Labour government in the 1940s is for the knacker's yard.
And one of the things that the locals told me down there is that you've got basically cancer clusters already around Bradwell A. And yet the entire industry is totally in denial about this, even though people like Dr. Chris Busby have proved it beyond any shadow of a doubt. That these leukemia clusters, these cancer clusters are there. The industry says, no, nothing to see here.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's obviously issues about safety with nuclear power. There's other issues about whether it's actually viable. I mean, she mentioned their wind power and solar power. And of course, the real answer to energy problems is energy efficiency. If we made the regulations for things like building houses and making cars and all the other things that we use energy efficient, we wouldn't need to create new sources of energy. We should actually be trying to produce more stuff with less energy rather than trying to solve the problem by creating more energy and more stuff. But there you go.
Another point they made to me down there. Was that they've got one of the biggest, well, the biggest offshore wind farm in Europe is within sight of this power, this new so-called power, projected power station. And the idea is that these wind farms have to be switched off. In other words, the blades feather so that the blades aren't going around, because sometimes you've got, particularly on sunny days, you've got very little electricity being used, and the nuclear power station has to be on a kind of low level tick over. They can't switch it off. So instead they switch off the solar and the wind farms.
Well, I'm one of the things about pressurized water reactors, I remember reading about this years ago, is in the big 1976 drought, the French have got lots of pressurized water reactors. And guess what? The drought reduced the water table. So guess what? They had to switch them off. It's just a great big boiling kettle to boil water. That's all it is, but using nuclear power. But of course, the water is used to cool the reactor. And if you've got no water during a drought, you've got the same problem as anybody else trying to
do. Yeah, well, the clue is in the name, Bradwell-on-Sea. That isn't the case there. But I mean, I think this is definitely one to watch. The other thing, Martin, what about the politics of this? It's all being fueled with Chinese money.
Well, yes, and it all has to be subsidised. Both China and France, who are the main suppliers of nuclear power, subsidise it to the hilt. Now, if you've made, you know, more than half of your energy dependent on nuclear power, as the French have done, it's not really economic. But you can make it economic by selling it on, as long as other people buy your nuclear power and the electricity you've produced by it, then you can somehow get the losses back that you've made by investing.
But what about the politics of it? I mean, this is all being constructed by General Nuclear Power Group, and obviously we've got a trade war going on right now.
Well, in other words, do you know what might happen? The whole thing may collapse. And it may collapse because then energy demand collapses because there's a collapse in the world economy and so on. Lots of things which are dependent upon current conditions and quantitative easing and everybody presuming that you can get endless growth without any consequences. They're just potentially going to run up against the brick wall, aren't they?
Well, thanks, Martin Summers. Join us in a minute, please, as we take our weekly look around the world.